Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Arya Hidayard. He's a technologist who's running the engineering team at Shape Security. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for hosting me.
I'm thrilled. We've been trying to get together now for 3 years on the show, but our schedules have not lined up, and today they did.
All right. Perfect.
Yeah. I first learned about you when I was doing web automation, and I started playing with Phantom.js. How long ago did you work on that?
That was my handy work started about 7 years ago, and I think I announced it about Christmas 20-something, 2011. It's been in the process for a while, but I didn't have time to polish it and release it to the world. And finally, I had time back then, and it worked out. Mm-hmm. So it was a popular tool back then for web automation. It's less popular these days. There's a lot of other alternative, better alternative. Development kind of slowed down a little bit, but it had its run.
Why do you think it was so popular? Was it just because it was the idea that something headless would be valuable? I mean, I had done Selenium testing before, but of course that required a browser.
Yes, I think that was one of the major key points. You can just download an executable, pretty much self-contained, and you hit the ground running. So back then it's quite a hassle to set up Selenium, much, much easier these days. And I think that makes it a sort of alternative easy choice to do web automation, besides driving the true browser, of course.
Right, right. And now, 7 years in, it's quite popular, of course, the 20-plus thousand stars on GitHub. But as you said, it's winding down, perhaps? It's in maintenance mode?
I think it's sort of the victim of its own success. So there's only very few volunteering work happening right now. But since it was popular for a while, there's a massive expectation of what it should do, how the feature should be implemented, what should be in the next release, and so on and so forth. So there's a huge mismatch between the volunteering work happening for the development versus the expectation from the wild audience out there. And it's a sort of typical problem in successful open source project.
That's an interesting point. As a successful open source project, I assume that you had all of the experiences that any organizer has, which is people expecting a lot of free work.
That is true. So, interesting story. For instance, one time I packaged a new release and start building it for some platform, Linux and Mac OS, and I decided, okay, let me take a break. Let me get some sleep for tomorrow morning. I'll continue and build the executable for Windows. The next morning, lo and behold, the first email was, where is Windows? So I couldn't even imagine that someone is that hurry. And of course, it's in the beginning, I took it personally. But at the end of the day, I know that this is the expectation that people want from such projects.
Mm. Did you have anger or people yelling at you or people who not only wanted free work, but also demanded support and Sunday at 2 a.m?
I think every open source project mentor is bound to experience all kind of insults, but I use that as an opportunity to grow my skin and become thicker over time. I used to joke that if you want a free anger management course, just maintain an open source project.
Did that ever get you a feeling like you wanted to rage quit?
Sometimes, but at the end of the day, what counts is, first of all, it's impossible to please everyone anyway. So if you try that, you will fail no matter what. But at the end of the day, what counts is, as long as there are people benefiting from my work, whatever it is, whether it's Phantom.js or the other projects that I maintain, I think that's enough for me. I think the motivation is not to get fame and glory, but the motivation is to do volunteering work. And this is similar to, you package some care package or sandwich for some unfortunate, less fortunate people. And you feel that you couldn't do enough. And that's okay. As long as you've done your part and people are happy and you feel good. I think that should be the main motivation, not to seek fame or glory or anything else.
That seems like an extremely healthy attitude. I see a lot of people becoming very angry at open source and very angry at the time, the sense of being it being thankless work. How much of it do you think is attitude?
It's kind of becoming like that. I think it's just natural. It's human nature to demand more. And sometimes you, as a maintainer, you try to provide as much service as possible, but for the other end, because they haven't seen that you actually need to work. You need to have a day job. You need to take care of your family. You need to take care of your pets. You have other friends. They don't see that. So they assume that, oh, because you release this project for free, then that's all you do. You have nothing else in your life. So it's, in one way, it's unfair to expect any maintainer to work long hours to release features or to work on feature for the projects. At the same time, if you see some maintainers in real life, your perspective might change. Suddenly you realize, oh yeah, this person also needs to do a lot of different things. And then the expectation will be much, much different. I think it's the exposure. The nature of open source project is just you don't get to see the maintainer or the volunteer or the contributors of the project face to face. And that becomes challenging.
Had you ever thought about building a company around PhantomJS when it was at its peak? Or how important do you think it is to be OSS versus to be FOSS?
So there are two aspects to that. First, I don't think I have any business skills at all. So if I think of creating a company, it might be a big failure. And second, I think there's a huge difference between working on something as part of your job and working on something because you find it's fun. And I mentioned about, you mentioned about rage quit, but I think they emphasize here is if you find or if you reach a point where maintaining an open source project is not fun, then stop doing that. Nobody forces you to do that. So you should become depressed because you volunteer some work. So there's that aspect where my biggest fear is that if this turn into a job, then I will enjoy less. For me, doing free and open source software is kind of therapeutic because I also have a day job and think of it as a hobby as opposed to something that I do to earn my living.
There's a great section on your GitHub called AMA. I've never seen anyone do this before. You've made an Ask Me Anything and you're using GitHub issues to do the answers to the AMA. Did you have this idea or is this a unique idea?
This is not unique at all. I think I'm probably the 200th person that does that. So that it's a fork of the original AMA. Uh-huh. And a lot of very well-known developer have done that.
I like this idea. I may do this myself.
Please do.
Yeah. So on this one, you have a particular AMA. It's number 20 that says, what are the three most underrated, overlooked open source projects? Such a great question. I don't know do you have that up in front of you? If not, I can read it to you.
I do.
So what are some of your favorite underrated or overlooked projects?
So I put Free Pascal on the list. I think...
Free Pascal.
Pascal, yes. If you remember Turbo Pascal, that is, among others, the first encounter to a lot of teenagers back then to the world of programming. And Free Pascal is the implementation of Pascal, of GPL implementation. And it has been in the development for 20 years. And there's no indication that it's going to stop anytime soon. It supports everything from 16-bit DOS, if you still remember that, to writing Pascal for iOS, 64-bit ARM. I find that extremely fascinating. These days, everyone is really into JavaScript, but for some of us who had the experience of learning, you know, basic Pascal and so on and so forth, Pascal is still one of the easiest barrier into programming.
Yeah, it is. I started in Visual Basic 3, but then immediately went into Pascal. I did Turbo Pascal back in 1993. I did Delphi. And as you said, I think the most interesting aspect of this is that it supports 16-bit DOS and 64-bit ARM, which is such a an interesting idea that this language, you know, short of C, it just kind of continues and continues and continues. And it's much easier to read than some of the other languages like Lisp that have so much wide system support.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a component library and a full-blown IDE called Lazarus. Just the other day, I needed to create something. I'm running Windows 10, and mm-hmm. I need to create a little utility with GUI. And this is the fastest I could imagine. I just launched Lazarus, put a bunch of components, write some logic, and lo and behold, it's up and running in a few minutes.
Interesting. And which sounds a lot like Visual Basic, right?
Right.
It's that 4GL experience, and you can just drag some buttons and have some button click events.
And if you want, you can compile another version for, say, Linux or macOS.
Hmm. Is this an application that is kind of sneaking its way under the radar? Why isn't everyone talking about Free Pascal?
Maybe because Pascal is not popular anymore. I know that as soon as there was C and C++ and Java and C Sharp, of course, Pascal is considered old-fashioned. I don't know.
Hmm. It's interesting because yesterday I was hacking into my Nintendo Wii and wanted to maybe write some programs for it. And of course, there you go, freepascal.org. You can download runtimes for the Nintendo Wii.
I didn't know that it also supports Nintendo Wii. That's now you give me an idea.
See, now you're going to think about what you can move over to the Wii. Who knows? What will be the next application?
16-bit DOS is supported. I'm sure it's much easier to support Nintendo Wii as a platform.
Yeah. Okay, what's another one?
The other one is Apache Traffic Server. People are probably familiar with Apache HTTP Server and another popular server such as Nginx. Traffic mm-hmm. Server is very similar to Nginx as a form of reverse proxy. This is not usually very well known for normal developer because unless you work on a server side web acceleration technology, then it's not very very well known. Again, it processes terabit per second of traffic at Yahoo, and I can't remember another company sponsor of this. Traffic Server was originated for Inktomi, if you still remember those days.
Oh, wow.
Inktomi was acquired by Yahoo, and Yahoo decided, hey, let's just make this open source. So they released the source code. In fact, in some part of the source code, you can still see the reference to Inktomi.
Really? And do you think that there's still value in Traffic Server in a world of Nginx?
Oh, yeah. It's still being widely used. Mm-hmm. We just don't know about it. And now it's part of the project under Apache Foundation.
Mm-hmm. And quietly handling 400 terabytes a day at Yahoo.
It supports HTTP2, WebSocket, all the latest technology, you name it.
Interesting. You know, the two things that I'm finding in common between Free Pascal and Apache Traffic Server are that their websites look old-fashioned. I wonder if people are likely to stumble on an open source project, see a website that's not Bootstrap or not pretty or not a fancy WordPress theme, and they simply write it off.
On the other hand, it's functional.
On the other hand, it's functional. See, there is a t-shirt right there that we need to make.
And it's lasts for more than a decade, so it's a true testament to its survivability.
Do you think that people in open source in 2017 are a little frivolous with their preferences? Maybe a little bit not, they're interested in the new thing and they run towards the new thing rather than thinking about the reliable old thing?
It might be the problem that we create ourselves because we tend to glorify new innovation, new projects, new library, new ways to do things in mm-hmm. all kind of forms, right? Newsletter or Medium post or Twitter or whatsoever. But we sometimes forget that we also need to celebrate a long-lasting project. For instance, what if newsletters start to mention, hey, this project so-and-so, celebrate its fourth birthday or fifth birthday, start from small number. Mm-hmm. And I think it will draw more attention to the fact that sometime there are projects designed for weekend fun. There are projects that can survive years and years of ups and downs. And if we look at GitHub as the form of the center of social coding, there's no way to distinguish between project that I throw together and then I feel that, someone might find it useful and put it up there versus I took some time to design this years and I took some time to come up with the proper architecture And I hope when I release this, it's going to last for 100 years. There's no really label for that. And therefore, it's hard for folks to understand that some projects have different trade-off than other projects.
Do you think that it's possible to start a project and say this one is going to be around for a long time and this one's not? Or are you saying that you just don't know, you never have a way of knowing when you try something out if it's going to become the next Ruby or the next Node? Everyone's just out there coming up with new ideas and maybe it sticks and maybe it doesn't.
It's hard to say. On one hand, as long as there's demand, as long as there's need for that project, and there is still maintenance motivations, I think that project is going to last for a while. I observe a lot of projects which are successful, projects which fail after just a few months, and so on and so forth. And I observe that sometimes if you try not to be too ambitious on your first release, if you try small and then improve it, some parts of the project and improve another part and implement some of the features and so on and so forth, I think that's going to last much longer than you create the project just to fulfill your adrenaline rush. In other words, there's a famous saying that you just need to run faster than a friend if you some bear is trying to catch you. I think rather than coming up with the best possible technology and with zero defects or bugs on your first release, if you improve your project one thing at a time, one feature per week or per month or whatever it is, and you keep doing that for years and years, you are going to outrun everyone. Even if every project was superior in the very beginning, it doesn't really matter. If you walk one step at a time, eventually you reach a very, very far destination compared to someone who just, you know, sprint and then stop. So just like in sport, there's a huge difference between focusing on endurance and focusing on speed. For instance, I don't have any endurance. I'm not too physically fit, so I can't run marathon. But if you ask me to play basketball or badminton where you need this high speed for just a couple of seconds, I could do that. And after that, I need to catch my breath, of course. So there's a huge difference between people who like to do one little thing every week, every month, versus someone who, I have this crazy thought, I want to create this project, and in a month, I'm just going to wrap it up, release it to the open source community as a gift, but then don't ask me about any support whatsoever.
It sounds like you've got a very positive attitude about not only life, but code, in that you're saying continuous improvement, small, measurable improvement, always moving forward with a positive attitude. Not big, giant sprints, not Herculean efforts, just consistency.
Correct. And I think it's important because when I look at these projects, I don't know if you remember this, but a few weeks ago, the maintainer for glibc steps down after 30 years of maintenance of glibc. That's unheard of. And we need to learn from these folks, from these projects, because I think these maintainers deserve some respect, and we should start to highlight them as opposed to just new projects. And that way, we also start to give examples to new folks, to open source, that, yeah, it's okay to do one thing, one small thing every week consistently for years and years, and keep doing that and keep getting new inspiration, getting in touch with new people or support new platforms such as Free Pascal. That's not a bad thing. That's also an honorable thing.
Yeah, the maintainer that you're referring to is Roland McGrath, who started working on glibc when he was 15 in 1987, and spent 30 years working on that project. So not starting as a professional, but definitely ending as one.
I'm sure there are people in your podcast listener, or even their parents, who were not born yet when Roland started maintaining glibc.
I was also a teenager in 1987. I may have been reading Roland's mailing lists because we were contemporaries, but definitely not as accomplished. And I'm sure, very sure, that there are people who are listening who were both very experienced at that time and who also, as you said, were not born yet. There's definitely a lot of tools that would have been created in the last 30 years since Roland started on glibc. You also call that a third open source project that is a source code management system?
Yes, Fossil And it was born about the same time when Git was born.
Mm-hmm.
One of the crazy things about Fossil is that it's not only version control. It's not only like Git where you store code, but it also mm-hmm. has Wiki and issue tracker, and everything is integrated. And the repository file is one single file, which is a database. It's a SQL database. It is created by Richard Hipp, which is also the author of SQLite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just as powerful as Git, but not very popular.
Not very popular. A very simple-looking, modest website with no real sense of dates when it was created, how long it is, how old it is, but has some really interesting and innovative features that I frankly wish that we had in Git. One of the most impressive things about Fossil, you can get it at fossil-scm.org, is that you can type Fossil UI and then the name of your repository, and suddenly it will pop up a web browser with a local web server. What a clever idea.
I think Git has the same features, but this is one thing where simple features makes a huge difference. If you have multiple repository, you can keep typing Fossil UI for each repository, and it will search for the first unused TCP port to mm-hmm. serve that web server. So you can have three different web browsing sessions as a GUI interface to three different Fossil repositories. That mm-hmm. is not easily possible with Git.
Yeah. Well, Git has an extension called Git Web UI, but I did not know if Git itself has this same kind of feature.
It does. It does.
Oh, really? Do you know how I can learn about that? You're teaching me something right now.
I think I tweet about that some time ago, but I forgot about it.
I will go and look for your tweets.
The most amazing thing about Fossil is everything is in one single self-contained executable file. And on Windows, the executable file is 2 megabytes something.
Really?
So a Taylor Swift song is larger than all these features packed into Fossil.
Or the average animated GIF.
Right.
Interesting. And it does make you wonder, though, again, why these kinds of features don't win, you know? And I think that the thing that we're seeing about all of the things that you're bringing up are a certain sense of modesty, of simplicity, of a certain kind of elegance.
I'm also curious, maybe it's also because there's no scandal, there's no story, there's no drama, and therefore it doesn't draw any attention. Fossil does exactly what it promises you to do, and it doesn't do more. There's no, the maintainer is an extremely reasonable gentleman, so there's no controversy or that kind of thing.
Interesting. I feel like you touched on that a little bit. You're referring to the actual maintainer of the project rather than the project itself. Are you thinking that some projects we learn more about because they have big personalities behind them?
Or there's some friction or differences in opinion, strong opinions, that causes it to get picked up by, say, some other folks and appears in some Medium posts and, you know, all tweets and that kind of thing.
Interesting. And that's not necessarily what you want in a healthy project.
Right. Another thing that is interesting is that some of these projects have excellent, excellent documentation. I cannot emphasize that enough. And therefore, sometimes you don't need to ask anyone about it, or you don't need to throw a question to Stack Overflow or mailing list or any other form. And therefore, people will encounter that less compared to, hey, this tool is fantastic, I don't know how to do it, just ask everyone and see if someone comes up with a solution.
Yeah, that is the number one thing that is so important about open source projects is good documentation, and so much of the new stuff doesn't have good documentation.
Both in the form of written documentation or even in a form of verbal, in case someone gives a talk or a presentation about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I found that web server that you were mentioning that was built into Git. It's called InstaWeb, and I found your tweet on it that I'll include in the show notes. It turns out the reason that I don't know about it is that it only works on non-Windows devices. So now you've given me a task. I'm going to go learn how to make that work on Windows.
We can use the Windows subsystem for Linux.
That's a great point. I bet you that would work out of the box on that. So now I'll try that after we're done. That's fantastic.
Which is
that's Git InstaWeb.
My favorite feature of Windows 10.
Interesting. So you mentioned that you have a Windows machine. Did you need that Linux subsystem, or were you a Windows person before?
I switched to Windows from Mac OS X precisely because there is Windows subsystem for Linux. Not that I can't use Windows, but there are certain things that makes it easier to work on real Linux system.
Mm-hmm. And you found that it was complete enough, that it allowed you to get done what you needed to get done?
Yeah, absolutely. Although you and others mentioned that running GUI is not really supported, it works well.
Interesting.
In cases where I need it.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing that I found that I was not able to do with it was things like Docker, where, Docker server. I can run Docker as a client, but not more than that. So kernel level stuff or low level hardware things where I wanted to talk to a serial port, I was unable to do. But 99% of everything else I've had no issues with.
Completely agree. And it's also fantastic because it's the vanilla Linux. It's not some other project that you need to compile yourself if the binary is not available and, that kind of hassle.
Yeah, absolutely. So what are you doing at Shape?
I am running the 50-person engineering team at Shape for about almost 4 years right now. We are specialized in preventing automated attacks on web and API servers.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, we can't disclose our customers, but so far, we have big customers in the verticals of airlines, surface and system, retails, and so on.
Mm-hmm. The reason that I ask is because there's been a theme kind of throughout our interview today, which is the sense of calmness, of gently moving forward. And on your blog, you talked about the concept of emotional resilience, particularly when creating a small organization or working on a startup. Can you talk a little bit about that?
This is definitely my own. I'm trying to document my own experience as I try to help Shape. This is my second startup. I used to work for Sencha. The maker of EXTJS, if you still remember that framework.
Mm-hmm.
And as we grow the team, we try to identify what makes a great team, why certain team works or certain composition of teams work and certain won't. And one of the common theme is that apparently great teams have this resilience built in into them so that it creates a healthy organization. It can reject or it can defeat all kind of intervention from external or internal because it's resilient enough to bounce back from that moment and then start to pursue its mission.
When you're in a tech startup that is really high risk, it can be really stressful if you make mistakes, though, and that can break people down emotionally.
Absolutely. We have to be extremely careful about that. We need to understand why someone is working there. What is their motivation? What makes them tick? What makes them successful? What are the strengths? How can we harness their strengths? Empathy is extremely important here. And there's a lot of discussion about engineers who become senior enough and then who become manager for the first time and didn't know what to do. And I think there's a lot of movement out there these days to start to educate everyone who get into that career path to understand what it takes to be a good manager, what it takes to be a good supervisor. I like the notion where you judge a manager by how much every individual is reporting to that manager's progress over time. So I view managers as a teacher. If all the students in a class for the teachers fail, then we give the blame to the teacher, of course.
That's a very challenging thing to translate your skills if you spend 5 or 10 years as an individual contributor, and then suddenly you're being judged not on your contributions, but on the sum of your team's contributions.
And I think this is why I believe there are many different career paths. An engineer who has the aspiration to continue to produce high quality code, maybe that's their strength. If they don't have the drive or the excitement and the happiness of making other people also as good as them, it doesn't have to, they don't need to be forced to become a manager or supervisor. Otherwise, you're going to lose one good engineer and you're going to get one bad manager. That's not a win-win situation.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you as the lead try to move the organization towards emotional resilience? Is it mostly by modeling that behavior?
Correct. So there's a lot of investment in building the relationship. I talk a lot about the book called Beyond Office Politics. Despite the title, carries the politics as a word. There's nothing bad about the book. In fact, it's extremely powerful. It describes why some people have certain drive, and it also allows you to be able to form a certain kind of relation that makes that organization healthy. There's also another book dealing with conflict resolution. I love Crucial Conversation and Verbal Judo. And I think investing in the relationship between individuals, between managers, those are the keys to create the highly productive, fast-paced tech organization.
Mm-hmm. How important is this this idea of emotional health as opposed to technical health? I noticed in your list of books that you recommend, there's fewer technical books than I would expect. You suggest books on personal productivity and office politics, and somehow that surprised me. I think of you as being a very technical person.
I think it's boils down to one thing. So if you don't know something, we can learn about it, and it's really fast to learn something technical because you have a lot of resources to do that. On the other hand, things like how to build a healthy organization, it's not really exact science, and therefore to measure it, it's very hard. And there's also cultural differences that you need to be aware of, and therefore, if you see that one organization is successful with certain recipe, it doesn't mean that suddenly it works for you. There's a lot of tweaks and a lot of customization necessary, and I think it warrants a lot of attention. We were born not being able to speak any language. Yes, in a few years, we couldn't communicate with our parents with various using various language. So I don't think there's a huge barrier in learning new technology. I think there's a undiscovered barriers in building relationship and building healthy organization.
That's cool. I really appreciate your positive attitude, and I appreciate the time that you've given me today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.